Riding in my car, screaming at the night, screaming at the dark, screaming at fright. I wasn't doing nothing, just driving about, screaming at the dark, letting it out. That's all I was doing, just letting it out. Psycho, very much to my surprise, I said, "Officer, was I speeding?" I couldn't see his eyes. He said, "No, you weren't speeding," and he felt where his gun was hung. He said, "Lady, you were screaming at the top of your lung, and you were doing it alone, you were doing it alone. You were screaming in your car in the 20-mile zone. You were doing it alone, you were doing it alone. You were screaming, you were doing it alone. I said, I'll roll up all my windows, don't wanna disturb the peace. I'm just a creature who's looking for a little release. I said, what's so wrong with screaming? Don't you do it at your games. When the quarterback breaks an elbow, when the boxer beats a mains. But you were doing it alone, you were doing it alone. You were screaming in your car in the 20-mile zone. You were doing it alone, you were doing it alone. You were screaming. Animals roar when they feel like. I said, why can't we do that too? Instead of screaming, bonsai baby. In the war, in the human. He said, I got to take you in now. Follow me right behind. And let's have no more screaming, like you're out of your mind. So we climbed aboard his cycle, and his red-eyed headlight beamed, and his motor started spinning, and his siren screamed. He was doing it alone. He was doing it alone. He was screaming on his bike in a 20-mile zone. He was doing it alone. He was doing it alone. He was screaming. I was doing it alone. I was doing it alone. I was screaming in my car in the 20-mile zone. I was doing it alone. I was doing it alone. I was screaming. We were doing it together. We were doing it together. We were screaming at the dark in the 20-mile zone. We were doing it together. We were doing it together. We were screaming. We were doing it together. 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 We were doing it together alone. In the 20-mile zone.
When I set out to do this program, I began with the idea that somehow there was a whole area of woman's life that causes her difficulty, soul-searching, pain, even anguish. An area which is not adequately covered by the demands of women's lib, that was perhaps related in some way to her difficulties in achieving equality with men, but was more in the private realm, the private pain that a sensitive woman experiences from life. Pain not solely experienced by women, but intensified by her femininity. The pain she experiences by having a feminine psyche. The pain of coping with a male-dominated society. The anguish of the male-female relationship, of sex, of children, of functioning in the role society sets for a woman, while at the same time wanting to leave your mark on that society in some totally different role. The pain of being at the centre of life, of birth, the menstrual cycle, creation. This anguish is nothing new to our present age. It can be seen in the few but especially brilliant women writers who've managed to surface from the sea of male culture from time to time. There is much pain beneath the seemingly social niceties of Jane Austen. George Eliot, writing Heaven Help Her in Victorian England under a man's name, conveys perfectly the agony of the enormously bright, uncompromising yet feminine female artist. But what of women writers today? I've invited three of them who seem to me, through their sensitivity, their caring, their gifts as writers and women, to most succinctly express for the present generation what I've called the female angst.
Mine was a Wednesday death. One afternoon at approximately 3:15. I gave up and died, and nobody cried. Mine was a bloodless death, not grim, not gory. More like Ally McGraw's new enzyme detergent demise in love story. Neat and tidy, unlike Christ's on Friday. Friends were fooled by the fact I still breathed, and I spoke, and I smiled, and I lied. In my handy-dandy imitation life disguise kit, I sent away for it. Styrofoam face fits so neatly in place with the pre-recorded voice of your choice, and it almost sounds real. It's a guarantee deal. You don't feel a thing. You can teach it to sing, and all your friends are deceived, and nobody grieves.
Anaïs Nin has already fought most of her battles and won. As a writer and a woman working in the 20s and 30s, she couldn't get her work published at all. The critics, all men, at worst ignored her, at best patronized her. So she set up her own printing press to produce her novels and went on to success from there. Now, after innumerable successful works, she's written four diaries covering her early life and work, which are invaluable because they show us the struggle of a sensitive woman to grow as woman and artist within a totally male framework, yet wanting and needing the approval of the male figure on her own terms. Here's an extract from the fourth diary. At Edmund Wilson's, I dislike the dismal, joyless house of the father, his power in the literary world, the solidity of his environment, his good manners, his taste for classical literature. I remembered that many years ago, when we read Wilson in Paris, I disagreed with his saying that Joyce had invented the contents of Ulysses Unconscious, since no unconscious ever contained so many allusions and associations. He does not understand my way of life. He does not understand that I refrain from firing up his neurosis. I am a very quarrelsome man. Sometimes I suspect that I see him just to prove to myself I could never live in what others call the mature world. I always experience a desire to postpone my visits with Wilson. While he confines himself to admiring me as a woman, we are safe. He is not the man creating the future. He is tradition. He is crystallized and inflexible. He tells me that he's always loved two contrasting types of women, one destructive, one kind and creative. To me, he seemed to have this hardening of the arteries I find in men of achievement, the florid skin, the satiated flesh, the solidity of the earth and its heaviness. He's didactic. He has conventional ideas about form and style. He has scholarship. He is all brown. Brown earth, brown thought, brown writing. His descriptions of life with Mary McCarthy sound like Jacob Wasserman's character Garnet in Dr. Kirkhoven. Father, man, critic, enemy of the artist. You are a woman who does not destroy man. That may be true, but he is a man who would destroy me. Miss Nin, Edmund Wilson said in one of his reviews of one of your books that you deal with conflicts created for women by living half in a man-controlled world, against which they cannot help rebelling, and half in a world which they've made for themselves, but which they cannot find completely satisfactory.
That's one of the themes of volume four. I think it's run through all the diaries, really. I wasn't very as conscious as we are now of the evolution of woman. I wasn't as conscious of the difficulties I had in expanding and growing. And I think Wilson was right in saying, I had not yet created my own world in which I felt that I could move independently, and at the same time I wanted to move in relation to man and was believed in relationship, so that I had to bring everything with me, involve the man in my own expansions, and it was difficult. It was difficult to do that.
But you seem to be saying that you weren't as aware of the difficulties then as you are looking back on them.
Not so conscious. I suppose I expressed them spontaneously in the diary, almost subconsciously. I wasn't so aware. Two things. I wasn't as aware that it was happening to so many women. I knew that there were difficulties. My women friends were in difficulties when they wanted to paint, that the devotion to the man came first, the devotion to the family and to the personal relationships. I became much more aware the last few years, really, more conscious, let's say, of something that was more subconscious.
Is that anything to do with the fact that nowadays all of these things have labels? Women's Lib have
yes.
put labels on the difficulties, and they're more categorized than they
were. Yes, they're more organized. They mention the things that I didn't know about, the laws, you know, a lot of things that I didn't know about, inequalities in work, and so we're more conscious of the situation as a whole, or historical and political. But in my own period, the way I expressed that, you see, was my rebellion against Wilson, what he represented. Mm. And for one thing, he did not accept my work or me as I was. He wanted to recreate me. And there's a very interesting statement in his own diary, which came out recently, where he says that he wanted to instruct a woman.
Yes.
And that he was so sorry that his daughter was not interested in being instructed by him, and he was interested in a girl a similar age to his daughter because she asked him questions about history.
Yeah.
And this, of course, is something I didn't want.
But he obviously had difficulties with creative women anyway, didn't he? I mean, there's some...
Because he really wanted to instruct them. He wanted to create them, you know, to his own image or whatever it was that he thought about literature.
Yes.
And his... Two things gave him away in his new diary. He said that he wished he could situate himself back into the 18th century, that that's the century he loved,
yes.
which, of course, where I didn't belong.
Yes.
And the fact that he... of course, it wasn't necessarily a cruel thing, but he did want to control the women writers, as he thought, to teach them, being the critic.
But he said they were that one of the great difficulties of his life was the fact that he was attracted to intelligent women and they were always impossibly neurotic. Do you think that's true? Do you think that a woman who feels and creates is generally more neurotic or feels
no,
more pain?
No, I
than
do
others?
Think that the only way that woman could express at that time, for instance, my differing from his opinion, my differences from his opinions or his ideas of writing were very... frustrating to me, and it would cause neurotic reactions. In a sense, today I would simply say, look, your idea of writing is different from mine. I am sure of mine, but woman is not quite so, as we have discovered in the last few years, self-confident as we think, or as sure. I can't have been as sure of myself. I still needed the father or the big critic who would say, you're fine, you know, you're going along fine, you're
yes.
a good writer.
Yes.
And because I needed that, then whoever didn't do that became a very threatening force. That's a neurotic reaction.
And that's why Edmund Wilson, particularly in the fourth diary, becomes your threatening force.
He becomes a figure of you see, he's trying to make me self-doubt, give me self-doubt again. And I had spent my whole life trying to reach a certain type of writing. Mm. Now, if I had been absolutely secure then, as I feel today about my work, I could have said very simply, I wouldn't even have had a quarrel with him.
Yes.
I could have simply said, you know, you live in the 18th century, I'm trying to innovate something in writing, and I'm writing as a woman, and I wouldn't have been neurotic about it, that's true. We're only neurotic if we feel something is harming us.
Yes. The word neurosis and neurotic and so on appears very often in the diary, in the fourth diary, and you describe it more in terms of the ability to feel more than other people, the ability to care more. I think there's somewhere you said a woman suffers more. You were talking about relationships, sacrifices more and cares more. Well, I suppose from the outside that does look frequently
like... It seemed to me that way, this is from my knowledge of my friends. You see, I had so many women friends who were really very gifted. Ultimately, they would always give up. One of them that I mentioned in the diary gave up her painting and became in partnership with her husband's work because her husband's work was so demanding.
But this suffering, be it in terms of human relationships or be it just in the ability to feel more than some other people, does it make life more difficult for a woman, and particularly a creative woman?
It made life more difficult for the creative woman. In other words, if a woman lacked self-confidence, which I think she has, and was dependent on others for praise or for approval, it made her very vulnerable. When I speak of neurosis, I really mean nothing more than what we used to call the romantic, that is, wanting the impossible thing and then being unhappy if it was not possible. Mm. The woman wanted somehow or other to grow, or at least I wanted to, and I know now it's reflected in many women. I wanted not only to do my work, but to be approved, to be helped, to be admired, to be inspired by the man. Mm-hmm. And that was not always forthcoming, although I must say, for the most part, men have helped me in my work.
The women's movement now, of course, has kind of gone away from that idea and it turned their back on men almost. Mm-hmm. And it's you talk about needing male approval and needing to be accepted into the...
At that time, yes, in the diary.
Would you still need it, do you think?
No, I think part of our maturity, what I call outgrowing the neurosis, is really that we ought to be able to do our work and believe in ourselves without such approval. But I don't think any of us do. There's always someone whose judgment we need.
Do you think then that the male as such has been one of the chief sources of pain to the creative female?
Yes, because we set him up, we accepted him as the philosopher, we accepted him as a historian, we accepted him as a psychologist, and all these fields which had an influence on our education, you see, we gave him this kind of power. And when you go through the process of psychoanalysis and when you go through the process of self-discovery, you realize that you should not give anybody the power to decide what is right or wrong in your creativity. Mm. I mean, the critic should not be outside, it should be within yourself. And when you reach maturity, which I finally have after a great many years, I find now that I'm the judge of my own work, and if I need opinions and reactions, it's true, but they're not fatal, you see, they wouldn't keep me from working.
You were talking too about the function of woman and how woman acts in terms of an agent almost, a catalyst for the rest of the community, and I think you described it as, oh yes, here it is, woman as nature, woman as the mirror, poetry and art, and you said the mirror is also an expression of fear, the fear of truth, and the mirror allows us to contemplate nature while out of danger. Do you think that struck me as being a tremendously graphic way of describing the function of woman?
Yes, because we thought of woman, for example, even the fact of writing a diary actually is a sensitive recording and portrayal and reflection of life. There are two things involved there, that the art, the mirror I sometimes use as a form of art, is where we reflect nature without being in danger, where it's transmuted into a form that is no longer lethal, as experience can be. And then there's also the mirror that the woman always was for the male artist.
Mm-hmm.
And the mirror that I am in the diary in when I portray others.
Does it mean also that in some sense the woman's suffering enables the rest of humanity to see deeper and to see some of the kind of mystical values underneath things, while at the same time not endangering themselves in any way and not becoming neurotic themselves, as it were?
There's a difference between suffering and neurotic suffering and suffering. I think some of the things that women suffered were absolutely realistic conditions which made her life as an artist very difficult. There were many, many more obstacles, say, than there were for the male artist, or the male artist encounters mm-hmm. plenty of them. That's the genuine suffering. The neurotic suffering comes when this creativity and this growth is frustrated. either by social conditions, by family conditions, by educational conditions, whatever the atmosphere is, then it becomes neurosis, it becomes negative.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the neurosis theme in our time is almost a collective one.
But
I think there's been a collective frustration for all creativity and all expansion of the individual.
The danger, of course, is, isn't it, that instead of directing or channeling that suffering into some kind of creativity, which it can enrich enormously, that you can go over the edge into kind of neurosis and withdrawal.
Yes.
And
yes. But then that's happened to men artists too. We've had the poets go mad. We've had Rimbaud walk out of his poetic existence. We had the madness of Artaud. And I think that many women, instead, the only thing they did, and we have recently the poet who wrote The Glass Jar.
Sylvia Plath.
Mm. We consider those symptoms of women who were not able to fulfill themselves and then decided in the favor of death. But then women usually chose a quieter way of withdrawing from activity, which is simply to live in the home and give up the piano or give up the painting or give up the writing.
But do you think it's symptomatic of the same thing, do you?
It's just yes, it's the same. It's the same as Rimbaud's walking off.
Yes.
I mean, except that it's not so dramatized. It's not dramatic. She just withdraws into her personal life and then takes care of her children or does whatever is in her personal life, but gives up the other challenge.
And it represents the same kind of loss in the last resort.
I think it does. I think it represents a great loss in terms of culture, in terms of history, and that woman did have a major, great contribution. And I found a most beautiful quotation the other day from Marion Mannes saying that the whole process of culture, you see, which had been too much in favor of the masculine principle, the day that those two worked together and in unison, we would really have something very wonderful.
Mm-hmm. But it certainly hasn't happened yet.
No, it isn't. It's happening. It went too far. The balance went too far into the masculine concept of the world, and then now women are trying to straighten that out by going too far in the other direction.
Yes.
And isolating themselves and separating from the man and having their own sort of fanatical prejudices too, which I really don't go along with. But that's the transitional stage. Maybe when they both feel strong enough to work in unison, when the woman doesn't feel so endangered. You see, mm-hmm. if I hadn't felt so endangered by Wilson, we could have had a very interesting friendship.
Yes, yes.
Friendship of opposites. Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing, one of the most interesting things to me about your writing is that you never seem to be too threatened. There's always a kind of a strength in you, and one can see it, and one knows that no matter what comes along, you're never going to go under. I mean, I think you expressed it by saying, I care very much, but I will never die from caring. Whereas the other two writers that are part of this program, Joan Didion and Dorrie Prevent, may well die from caring too much.
Yes.
I mean, one gets the feeling with both of them that the edge that's keeping them back from dying is very thin indeed.
Yes.
What do you think are the qualities in you which made this less of a danger?
I think there was always a primary thing of the artist. You know, for example, when I refused destructive experiences such as drugs and all that, I would always say, because I'm a writer, I must stay lucid. Because I'm a writer, I'm not going... You see, I was able to transmute the sorrows. Whatever bitter experience or whatever difficult experience or frustrating experience, it all came out in work.
Yes.
And that was my salvation. And even today, you know, if I have to fight a very deep depression, I sit at my desk at 7:30 and I begin to work and the depression goes away. So my salvation somehow was always in the work.
Yes.
And it happened.
And you, I mean, work obviously came easily to you. It wasn't a great tearing out experience. It
no.
was something that came
in. In other words, even in the bad periods of my life, I was able to work.
Freudian psychoanalysis obviously played a large part in your
not the life. Freudian. No, I found the Freudian very limited, as I explained in when I depicted Alain D.
Mm-hmm.
Very limited experience. It wasn't Freudian, it was a Rankin psychology, which I think has its termination in Lang, R.D.
Mm-hmm.
Lang,
mm-hmm.
who pushed the barriers very much further than Freud did.
Yes.
And also who understood the process of creation much better.
Yes. because, and I was interested because, of course, the women's movement has kind of swung away from Freud particularly and psychoanalysis
yes.
in general.
I think they've done a very rather mistaken thing. In swinging away from Freud, they think that they have disposed of the contribution of psychoanalysis to liberation. And that is, I think, that was where I don't agree. Freud was at the beginning, and we've gone much further than that. And a great deal of psychoanalysis helped to liberate me and find out all the things that women are finding out today in a very rather haphazard and chaotic way. I had been able to sort out, you see, and to know about myself. For example, say the guilt about creating that that woman has. It's a typical subject. That's a subject the psychoanalysis deals with.
You mean the guilt of
feeling that the creation is an aggressive act.
Yes.
That it was something I had no right to do. If my father was a musician and my brother was a musician, I shouldn't really try to do anything that would cast a shadow on their thing.
Yes.
This is a very feminine thing, which women are beginning now to deal with.
Yes.
The idea that creation is an aggression, is an aggressive thing.
You don't feel that anymore.
No, no. The fear of the creation came from sort of the masculine part of ourselves.
Yes, yes.
That it was an active thing. They were not able to distinguish between aggression and activity. And this came out of discussion with a psychoanalyst, that there was a difference between aggressivity and activity.
Yes.
And that women had so long played a passive role, and that for creation you need an active role.
Yes. Do you think that women, in particularly in women's lib movements today, are still having great trouble in distinguishing
between
those two things?
I think they are. Yes, I really do. I think they are confusing aggressivity with activity, which is perfectly a part of creativity. And also creating new prejudices, you know, because not all men have endangered women's growth.
Mm-hmm. Apart from the negative role that certain men played in your career, like Edmund Wilson, men have obviously been a very positive factor in your life as well. In what ways chiefly do you think? How were men important in your processes of creation?
Well, you take, for example, a man like Henry Miller, who has been the target of the women's liberation. He encouraged me to write. He revised my English, which at that time still needed to be revised, because I was writing always, occasionally would use foreign turn of phrase.
Yes.
He took pains over my manuscripts and encouraged me. And rank encouraged me tremendously.
Yes.
They never diminished me or threatened me in any way. You see, the portrait of Wilson is quite a different thing. Rank was extremely helpful to me.
Mm. There's another little piece from the book that I wanted to discuss with you, and it was where you said, those who suffer from inner disturbances are contagious. I wondered if the writer feels intense pain at times through the creative process and shows it through the creative process and is more sensitive to unpleasant things. Do they help ameliorate conditions or do they make them worse?
No, they help. They help because, you see, my, let's say my sensitivity or hypersensitivity, if you want to make a flaw of it, which is sometimes what happens with the artist, he goes overboard. Insensitivity is the thing that makes me aware of others' feelings. Gives me empathy, gives me a capacity for reading what others need at the time, at a crucial time. For instance, answering a demand for SOSs, which people make in life. This kind of hypersensitivity can be creative.
Mm-hmm.
And it was particularly creative, say, in the work, in the observation of women, in relationship, in friendship. You can use it very well. I don't think it needs to become a sickly thing, you see, that makes one withdraw from the world or that you're too vulnerable and that's how you can't live your life. I think in my case, I used it as an instrument, as a highly sensitive instrument, which made me aware that others were in difficulties, men or women, both.
And so you weren't an unsettling force in any way, stirring up your environment. There's something that when one looks at you now, and when one looks at you in your pictures right through the time that you were working, there's never any doubt of your femininity or of, you know, your desire to look pretty, to look interesting, to look beautiful. And women today frequently feel that this is a threatening thing to them, that they oughtn't to have to, particularly if they're intellectual women, that they oughtn't have to bother about how they look or makeup and so on. Were you ever aware of this conflict? Was it ever a problem to you?
No, I always accepted that was part of being a woman, and I don't think that it is a threat because I never felt, for example, that it interfered with my intellectual relationships with men, that if I wanted it to be on that plane, and that was my particular interest in that special person, that it could be as well fulfilled as I say would be with a woman. I mean, there wasn't any reason why the sexual interplay should be a threatening one to women.
Yes.
And the other part about looking your best and all that, which I think women have gone, it's a negative rebellion against the slick and the over-standardization of beauty when making all women feel that if they don't reach that perfection, they are nowhere at all. I find that that's a negative reaction. That I think every woman has to bring her own natural beauty to a point as much as she can without, it doesn't mean that we have to look like Vogue or have
yes,
pattern.
Yes.
And I think that's a false idea of anti-aesthetics and that will falsify our relationship to men. I never found that out to be true.
And talking of the relationship to men as well, you said the development of woman in her own terms, not as an imitation of man, and the effort of woman to find her own psychology in contradiction to man-made psychology and interpretation, woman finding her own language and articulating her own feelings, discovering her own perceptions. And then you went on to talk about her evolution being from subjectivity and neurosis to objectivity, expansion and fulfillment. You have obviously found what you were talking about here, but how far away do you think it is for most women?
Some of them are very close to it, even younger women. I'm surprised if I compare where I was at 30 and where they are today at 30, I find it's very accelerated. They're way ahead.
Mm-hmm.
They have already more knowledge. They have more knowledge of what is happening in the world than I did. They have more knowledge of solutions. So I think they're going to do this process that I describe in the diary much more quickly.
Mm-hmm. What role will women's movements have in this? Do you think it's going to hinder?
No, I think it's been a beneficial thing on the whole, leaving aside the elements in it that none of us like, you know, the fanatical elements. It's made women very aware. It's made them organize. It's made them aware of solutions. See, the interesting thing is that when I was coping with these various problems, I was coping with them psychologically, but I didn't know, for instance, that there would ever be a solution to the abortion problem.
Yes.
I didn't realize that women could actually organize and change the law. Now, this I didn't know. This is what I learned from the movement, that there were things which I thought would always be so, that didn't have to be always so.
Are there any other things that you can think of that you would never have believed possible that you now see?
No, I never thought, for instance, women would have their own publishing houses, would have their own newspapers, would have their own Book of the Month Club, which now the Every Woman group is setting up. I think that this is all very good. I never thought that we would have in college courses on women's writing.
Mm-hmm.
And since these things were very unjustly handled, and women were not really given the proper place because the critics were men and the teachers were men, I mean, men did practice, you know, certain inequality. I think all this is going to make a very interesting, better balanced culture.
Yes.
Of course, there will be excesses. You know, there always are in a revolution.
Yeah, so we've got the excesses now. Hopefully, then they kind of filter down, don't they? You talked about having a tragic sense of life, and you said the tragic sense of life means one's obsession with an ideal, not a primitive natural life, but an ideal romanticized life. And you ask yourself, when was it that I set such ideals for myself and made my own life so difficult?
Well, this was the early diaries.
Yes.
This doesn't come from volume 4,
no,
does it?
No, no.
This is the early diaries where I was a romantic or neurotic, if you want to put it in the modern terms, and expected extraordinary things. This is no longer true. You begin to, maturity means that you begin to fuse what is possible, you know, with what you wanted, and also to see that your demands were really very exaggerated mm-hmm. and very inhuman mm-hmm. to others.
Was that one of the chief difficulties in your early life?
No, that was a problem which psychoanalysis dissolved.
Yes.
You see, psychoanalysis gives you a sense of reality, and I don't mean in accepting something lower of less quality than what you wanted, but in how to fulfill it. See, what I really learned was to how to attain these things that I really wanted, and they were not impossible.
And without, you managed it without too much of the pain that you went through at the beginning.
Yes. The early Taoists, you see, have more of the obstacles and the pains than the later one. In fact, the one I'm writing now is a very joyous volume.
When will that appear?
Oh, I think it takes me a year, you know, to edit.
Yes.
And then it takes almost a year to get published.
Joy is a word that you use, I mean, even in the earlier diaries, and you talk about joy in little things.
I was seeking that. I think the quest for joy is a very, you know, wonderful one, and I always did seek that in the middle of all the troubles. I mean, I really don't think the diaries, when I say tragic sense of life, it's because I don't like the comic sense of life.
Yes.
I don't like to laugh at things. I don't think they're very funny,
the things
we laugh at. But that's a different thing. There's another kind of playfulness in the diary. But play, in the way the artist uses it, with his imagination and trying to transpose and improve on reality, that kind of playful, a joyous thing, and the joy I find in nature, I found. See, so we must never give up these quests and immediately say that they are impossible to find.
But if the next diary is a joyous experience and comes out that way, then one can assume that you are at least part of the way to finding a joyous sense of life, and that the pain is now passing.
Yes.
If you had to, you know, the old question, if you had to do it all again, relive it and start creating from the beginning, knowing now what you do know, would your writing be very different? Would your life have been very different?
I don't think I would like to change that difficult inner voyage that I made. It was all very rich, and I wouldn't like to erase all the errors I made. I don't think I would change anything, really. Except the only thing I might have changed is I would like to have been accelerated.
Yes.
I would have liked it not to have taken so much time.
Do you think,
for instance, the acceptance of my writing took very long, and I can't say that I rejoice over that. It took 20 years.
But isn't it nicer in the end? I mean, isn't that
Yes. But I wish it had happened sooner.
Yeah.
But there are time elements that you'd like to have changed. I think mostly in the acceleration, which I think is what happened to this generation, which gives me great elation, is that they're accelerating. Their wisdom is accelerated, and what their experience is accelerated. And so they're not, you know, it's not so, such a long inner journey doesn't take quite so long.
Yes. Do you think then, on the whole, that women's greater capacity for suffering, if you like, or for feeling, is beneficial to her creative process?
Yes, it can be. It can be. It depends how it's used. As long as it doesn't... I'll give an example of that. For instance, when I couldn't be published, I might have become embittered. And before this happened, I took the press and I did the books. In other words, I wanted to convert, you see, something that might be rebellious and anger and bitter into action. The minute I had the press, I didn't care anymore about the publishers.
Yes.
And this is what I mean by, you know, the suffering doesn't need to be an acceptance of an immovable condition, but it drives you into change.
Miss Nin, thank you very much indeed.
Joan Didion has written, in addition to a vast body of non-fiction for the Saturday Evening Post and other American magazines, two novels, and has published a collection of her best non-fiction pieces, Slouching Towards Bethlehem. She writes of the confusion and awfulness of modern life, of death by violence, murder, rattlesnake bites, terrible acts of God, evil winds and the inability of things to hold at the center, the universal falling apart. She has been called this generation's supreme chronicler of angst. She has the ability to show us her own personal pain, and in so doing mirror, in the way that Anais Nin was talking about earlier, the savagery of nature while shielding us from it. This is a piece from Play It As It Lays. In January, there were poinsettias in front of all the bungalows between Melrose and Sunset, and the rain set in. And Maria wore not sandals, but rail shoes and a Shetland sweater she'd brought in New York the year she was 19. For days during the rain, she did not speak out loud or read a newspaper. She couldn't read newspapers because certain stories leapt at her from the page. The four-year-olds in the abandoned refrigerator, the tea party with Purex, the infant in the driveway, rattlesnake in the playpen, the peril, unspeakable peril in the everyday. She grew faint as the procession swept before her, the children alive when last scolded, dead when next seen, the children in the locked car burning, the little faces, helpless screams. The mothers were always reported to be under sedation. In the whole world, there was not as much sedation as there was instantaneous peril.
Joan, the National Review, in one of their reviews of, I think it was Slouching Towards Bethlehem, said of you, "She's passed beyond optimism and pessimism to a far country of quiet anguish, bringing us scant comfort." I wonder what the sources of those anguish, of that anguish, are chiefly, and how much of it has to do with being a woman.
Oh, I don't think any of it does, and I don't know. I don't think of myself as an anguished person particularly, but I'm not optimistic and I'm not pessimistic. The way I think doesn't seem to me to have a great deal specifically to do with being a woman. I wasn't brought up to terribly aware of any kind of special woman's role. I mean, it just never occurred to me that anything would be expected of me other than doing whatever I wanted to do. And I don't feel very specifically aware of women's anguish, mm-hmm. as opposed to general anguish, mm-hmm. to the anguish of being a human being.
Well, I know that you write about the anguish, for instance, of war, and the anguish of the human condition as manifested in things like Kate Ashbury and the drug culture and so on. But very often, your metaphors, if you like, for the general angst, if you like, that goes on in you, are female ones. For instance, you're talking about, at one point in Slouching Towards Bethlehem, about going over the edge into some kind of loss of control, some kind of madness, which shows itself with the sardine tins in the sink and the general slovenliness of the house, which is a kind of a very female concept.
Well, that comes up because actually, you know, I am a woman,
yes.
And so I do think in, I mean, the images that come to a woman's mind tend to be female, I suppose, but and I write women more with more facility than I write men,
mm-hmm.
And that's how that happens. But I don't. I did write a man once that I liked. I wrote a man once in my first novel, who I was as close to as the woman in that novel.
Yeah.
Oh, the woman was the main character. And I thought that he came off as well as the woman. But it was the only time I've ever really gotten into a man's
psyche.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Maria, in Play It As It Lays, is almost the story of a kind of a chronicle of anguish and fear. Which, I mean, strikes me as being her anguish is particularly female. I mean, particularly concerning her daughter and the feelings about her daughter and her abortion, and all of those images, all of the manifestations of her fear are particularly female ones.
Well, one of the things I was interested in that book, I mean, one of the things that started coming out of it as I was writing it was the kind of chain of, I mean, this isn't what the book was about, but what one of the things that kept coming to was that kind of chain between generations of women,
between Mariah and her daughter, and when she was particularly concerned about her daughter and about aborting the child, I found her thinking naturally about her mother. I mean, there was, it seemed to me to be some kind of chain of things understood by women that comes down. But that, I don't know what that means.
She's a particularly California kind of type. Her problems are particularly California ones, and her way of coping with them, like getting, you know, working out how she's going to negotiate the freeways every day and so on. And if you, I wondered about if you feel particularly sensitive towards the pains and the difficulties of living, why you would choose to live your life in California, where those difficulties seem to be immensely intensified.
Well, I was born in California and lived in New York for 8 years. And then after I was married, we moved to Los Angeles, which is a very different place from the place where I come from. And, well, I could only talk about it in two ways. One is that I find it easier to live here. I mean, easier in physical terms. I like living here. The other is that if there is a place that is, if there is a place in the world that is, that seems to me more real than any other place, I would rather be living there. California in many ways, or Los Angeles in many ways, strikes me as I feel very close to the reality of something here. Where I ceased feeling that way in New York.
What kind of reality are you talking about now?
I don't even know. At the time that I was writing Plays at Lays, and at the time that what Mariah is going through in that book is she's coming to terms with the meaninglessness of experience. And that's what everybody who lives in Los Angeles essentially has to come to terms with, because none of it seems to mean anything.
Is it kind of confronting the worst that there is, and therefore being able to cope with anything else that comes in?
I would think that was what people ought to do, yeah.
Yeah, because Dori Previn, of course, who's also on this program, feels pretty much the way you do, that I mean, for her, reality is even more important, because the grasp on reality is harder for her to maintain, and she maintains that this is the only place that she can
feel it.
Yeah.
And I would find it very difficult to live in a sheltered way, because I would keep feeling I was missing the point.
From, you know, you obviously, as you said, you're not optimistic and you're not pessimistic, but you obviously have enough sensitivity to grasp that life is essentially, as you say, meaningless, if you like. Do you then seek out subjects to intensify this, to show this meaninglessness? I mean, for instance, things like, I understood you were going to work on a book on Linda Kasabian, then you'd written a long piece on Haight-Ashbury and the Lucille Miller case and all of the most painful things you could get your hands on, really.
I'm not doing the book on Linda Kasabian now. I was working on one for a while. Well, there are certain things, I mean, it's not a conscious thing of seeking things out, but there are certain things that engage your imagination or don't. And sometimes something just sounds exactly
what you're looking for.
What you want, or not what you want, but what this is something you have to do. And I guess in that way it's an unconscious seeking out of...
Your piece on the hate was really... I mean, of the thousands and thousands and probably millions of words that were written about that situation, yours seemed to me to get to the heart of it more than anything else. And yet you said that you felt
I think you said, frustrated after it was published, that you were unhappy about it.
Well, it was a very odd piece to do because I was there for quite a long time, longer than I've ever spent before on a piece or after. And I kept staying because I kept having the sense that I wasn't getting it. I did not understand what was going on. And I finally came home, and I still didn't think I had it. I mean, I still, you know, sometimes, usually on a piece, there comes a day when you know you never have to do another interview. Mm-hmm. You can go home. You've mm-hmm. gotten it. Well, that day never came on that piece, and the piece had to be written right away. So I wrote it right away, but I wrote it just in a series of scenes, exactly how it happened to me. And that was the only way I could write it, because I had no conclusions at all. And
but at the end of it, did you still feel that you hadn't, even though, I mean, it was highly praised, and other people obviously thought that you had got said something significant about the whole movement?
That piece is a blank for me still. I can't. I have no idea whether it was good or bad.
Mm.
You
know, yeah. You zeroed in, and I notice you often do in other pieces, on the children as being, I mean, I think there was 3-year-old Michael,
mm-hmm.
Who lived in this kind of appalling barn thing and started fires, and the little girl Susan, who was on acid at 5. And is that part of your being a mother, do you think?
Well, that was very real to me then, because I had a 2-year-old at the time I was working on that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was particularly vivid to me to see these other children. And it was particularly vivid to me because I was away from the 2-year-old and feeling slightly
cut off
mm-hmm. from her, yeah.
How much of your time, how much of your fears of living, if that's the expression, kind of zero in on Quintana, on your own child?
Well, not a great deal. She's very, I mean, I am apprehensive about everything and anxious, so I have to try to not mm-hmm. lay this on her.
Yeah.
And, anyway, she wouldn't have any of it if I did try. I mean, she's very, very...
I think you described her at one point as being kind of child who likes to get up in the morning.
Oh, yeah, she's very competent. I mean, she's a...
Which brings me back to your own childhood. And the piece you wrote in Slouching Towards Bethlehem on keeping a notebook,
mm-hmm.
where you told what to me seemed an incredible story about your mother giving you this notebook. And the first story you chose to note down in that was about the woman who thought she was freezing to death in Alaska or something and woke up to find that she was dying of heat in the Sahara. And I think you were 5, you said.
Yeah.
And I wondered what kind of sensibility in a child can possibly take that kind of a story and put it down as the first entry in her new notebook.
Well, you know, I read someplace once that children in the nursery, I mean, within hours after birth, some children you can poke, the doctor can poke them, and they don't flinch. And some children flinch, and then they've done studies about these children. And the children who flinch turn out to be flinchers all their life,
yes.
And the others are extroverted or happy or competent children like my daughter.
Yeah.
Well, I think I was just a flincher at birth, you know.
So you're not a subscriber to environment, obviously, because your own environment sounded very stable.
It was. It was very stable. My brother is an entirely different kind of person from me. It was mystifying to my mother and father, I think, why I was so despondent.
Anais Nin, when she was here, talked a lot about the creative process in terms of neurosis.
Mm-hmm.
And the word neurotic was bandied about a lot. Do you think your anguish or your fears are realistic fears, or would you describe yourself as a neurotic? Well, at one point, I would have described myself as a neurotic. I used to think of myself as a neurotic when I was in college. I think that was during a period when everybody was thinking of themselves as neurotic. Mm. I don't know now. I don't really think now in terms of neurosis. I mean, I think in terms of only of extreme psychosis or normal. Mm-hmm. I mean, or you're getting along all right. Mm-hmm. Someone asked me last night why I had never gone into analysis because I was so shy. And I couldn't think what to say, and I said that finally I said, well, I wouldn't want to go into analysis because if I found out too much about myself, I might stop working, which is more important to mm-hmm. me than being good at a dinner party.
Inez wrote, I care very much about the human condition, but I will not die from caring. Do you think ever you're in danger of, if you like, dying metaphorically from caring, of caring too much and being unable to continue, therefore?
No. Not at this point, no.
Is it because you can put that caring into your work?
Well, I think that everybody goes through a period of disgust with, or I don't mean disgust in terms of irritation, but of kind of moral disgust with everybody else's, with the way the world is and everything. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it seems pointless to write. But then you go through that to the, you know, to just working for yourself alone.
Mm-hmm. But there are times, for instance, in the piece on Haight-Ashbury, when you're feeling that everything's falling apart and that the center cannot hold, is so intense that one wonders how on earth you can feel as intensely as that and still stay together and still stay functional.
Well, that's the trick.
that's the way it's done.
Yeah, I mean, that's the, I mean, that was a period when I did feel that there was maybe not much point in writing.
Mm-hmm.
But just my sheer interest in the techniques of writing kept me going.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I needed money.
what are you going to do? The Lindy Kasabian book is not coming on.
No.
What are you going to do next?
Well, I'm starting another novel. And starting a nonfiction book. And I don't know which. I'll do one for a while and then...
Jan, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Up until 3.5 years ago, Dori Previn wrote lyrics for her husband's movie scores. A talent, no doubt, but giving us no hint of the intensity of her feelings and her almost constant pain. After her divorce, she suffered a mental breakdown, and during her hospitalization, she began writing more lyrics. But this time they were poetry, telling of her childhood, her fears, her mental state, her desire for love, and her compassion for the lonely and afraid. These were later made into an album for which she sang her own music. On My Way to Where was the name of the album, and she's followed with Mythical Kings and Iguanas and her latest Taps, Tremors and Time Steps.
Need me more than I need you.
I danced to please my father, just to win one glance, some sign of his approval. I danced and danced and danced and danced. I smiled to make my mother proud I was her child, to gain some small attention. I smiled and smiled and smiled and smiled. My books and bikes I battered to try to buy a friend. Now I'm grown, this heart I own is the currency I spend and spend and spend. And in the end I'll give you everything I own. Sure, you'd never want me for myself alone. How I hate the way I am, always trying to impress. Lord, if I could love me, I could love you less.
When we recorded the following interview, I was not aware that the cover design for this month's program folio would depict Marilyn Monroe crucified, superimposed on Christ. It's now 3 years since Dory used the same symbols in her song, Scared to Be Alone.